Today is Tuesday, May 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a UN report finds nature is globally declining at an unprecedented rate. In a clear warning to Iran, the U.S. sends a striker ship to the Persian Gulf.
Our objective is to get the Islamic Republic of Iran to behave like a normal nation. When they do that, we will welcome them back. If part of that president said we're happy at the right time, if there's a negotiation that needs to take place, we're happy to engage in that.
Also ahead, Lady Gaga wows with four wardrobe changes at an extravagant gala. It's all on today's International Edition. One day after the United States said it would send a carrier strike group to the Middle East to counter a credible threat by Iranian regime forces, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Monday the United States has seen activity from Iran that indicated a possible escalation.
We have continued to see activity that leads us to believe that there's escalation that may be taking place. And so we're taking all the appropriate actions, both from a security perspective and well as our ability to make sure that the president has a wide range of options in the event that something should actually take place.
The action marked the latest in a series of moves by the Trump administration aimed at ratcheting up pressure on Iran in recent months. The Trump administration's efforts to impose political and economic isolation on Tehran began last year when it unilaterally withdrew from the nuclear deal it and other world powers negotiated with Iran in 2015. Joining us to discuss is Benham Ben Taliblu of the Washington-based foundation for the defense of democracies. What do you think of the latest U.S. move here?
I think this is a relatively appropriate response given several factors. The first is that on a bipartisan basis for almost two decades, if not longer, the U.S. has had a carrier in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. has used military posture in the region. Again, that's its hardened assets and its more mobile ships and airplanes to deter Iranian aggression and to make sure Iran stays within certain boundaries. Next is the May 8th deadline, which is the one-year walkout from when the U.S. left the JCPOA nuclear deal. The administration has certainly been dialing up the pressure on Iran almost all of it designed to get Iran back to the negotiating table. There's the IRGC FTO designation, the oil sanctions waiver termination, revoking select civil nuclear waivers, and now this. So it's consistent with a broader pattern from this administration. And lastly, I would just say that with the story you mentioned, there's some reports now that a foreign government, Israel, passed along intelligence that Iran was looking to respond or through one of its proxies against an American interest. My guess would be likely Iraq or another theater of conflict in the Middle East. This is one way to hedge against that, to offset that and to remind Iran of U.S. escalation dominance and to incentivize Iran to step down.
Do you think the U.S. is looking to go to war with Iran?
No, not at all. In fact, this reinforces the current posture of the United States in the region, which is a deterrent posture. That doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't have the capability, but the intent is not an offensive preemptive strike to make sure that Iran can see that at every juncture, at every flashpoint, at every spiral of escalation, it cannot win against the United States. And that should incentivize Iran to step back.
When you say step back from what? What are they doing specifically?
A short-term flashpoint is to not engage in that kind of terror attack or that strike that it or its proxy forces were debating against American interests. More broadly, it means pull back from some of its regional ambitions. If the U.S. cites now its growing posture in the region against a certain Iranian activity, like missile testing or missile transfers, that is one way to look at what Iran could amp up or roll back.
Do you think the U.S. would have been better off at least staying in the nuclear agreement?
Broadly, I was a proponent of fixing the deal because I think it's useful to have a diplomatic framework where you're united with the Europeans to press on Iran. But that being said, since May 8th, I've been an ardent defender of max pressure because there's no use crying over spilled milk here. And what we're defending now is not just U.S.-Iran policy. What needs to work is the coercive effect of America's peaceful tools, such as sanctions. We need to have sanctions success here. And Washington already deserves to be commended for replicating much of the economic pain that multilateral sanctions caused over 5 years through unilateral sanctions in 1 year.
What is the difference in what we're seeing with Iran or the concerns we're having with Iran and what is happening with North Korea as far as their provocative actions with missile testing and our completely different response to that?
I don't know exactly how different some of the U.S. responses are, but what I'll tell you is that the U.S. response is is not the most important thing to note here. The most important thing are each actor, Pyongyang and Tehran. And I say that because both of these are either nuclear-capable or nuclear-inclined rogue states, have revisionist intentions in their respective areas, that have a robust ballistic missile capability that's the product of decades of cooperation with one another, that engage in small arms sales and transfers and oil sales with one another, and that basically work together outside of the legal financial system, in my assessment, to pass information back about what they learned from negotiating with the United States. And with the North Korean short-range missile test, it ups the ante a little bit from its last, I believe the term the U.S. had used was tactical guided projectile. And so by testing a short-range missile, North Korea is gradually turning up the pressure, returning to missile testing, but in a very graduated, incremental way. I'm using the word graduated here specifically because graduated escalation is the name of the game with Tehran. Iran wouldn't dash outside of the nuclear deal immediately, in my view, it would incrementally put its foot outside the boundary because this is the nature of Iranian cheating. Same goes for Iran's decades-long designs on the Arab world and the Middle East. Iran isn't sending tanks and its formal army there. It's sending proxies in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps because it's gradually seeking to co-opt states and people and movements and institutions to more broadly subvert the regional balance against America. So the tactics are the same by these two states. Graduated escalation, testing out the administration. What had been different, of course, was that North Korea was actually looking to divide President Trump from Washington. They were praising the president and then critiquing Washington. Iran, for the bulk of the past 2 years, had been trying to log roll President Trump into the broader problems in Washington. But what you saw with Zarif's most recent trip was an attempt to divide the president from his cabinet and his cabinet from the international community. And I think this could be Iran taking yet another playbook from a page out of North Korea's playbook.
All right, that's Benham Ben Talibu of the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. is wary of Chinese and Russian military presence in the Arctic. Israel's Gaza blockade is under scrutiny after its latest violence. Pakistan arrests 10 Chinese suspected human traffickers. And how hippo dung is being put to good use in Africa. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A United Nations report issued Monday says 1 million plant and animal species are at risk of extinction because of human activity, many within decades. It warns that the rate of extinctions is accelerating and would likely cause serious damage to human well-being around the world. Scientists say species are going extinct up to several hundred times faster than the average rate during the past 10 million years. Sir Robert Watson, chair of the Intergovernmental Science and Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, which released the 1,800-page report, said it's not too late to save our threatened species, but it will require transformative changes.
If we stop converting our forests into agricultural, stop polluting our rivers, stop losing our mangrove systems, we can save most of those species. But up to 1 million species are threatened, but good actions from us can save most of those species.
Joining us to talk more about this report, Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thank you for being with us. So this wasn't a total surprise, but still it was jarring.
There's been a lot of research and studies that show that we're in an extinction crisis, that species are going extinct at a greatly accelerated rate, and that the primary cause of that is us. And so it's a great concern. The difference here is that, one, it's the UN, and two, it's scientists from around the world have come together to produce this report and really raise the alarm bells.
If you look at it in a non-scientific way, just as just a general human being, and you think about the beauty of this planet and growing up. For me personally, I never would have thought as a child that one day in my lifetime, some of these beautiful beings would just be gone because of what humans are doing. It's just not something we would have even been on our radar.
I was born in 1968, and there was was less than half as many people when I was born. There was roughly 3.5 billion. Now there's over 7 billion. Mm. And our consumption has grown per capita as well. So it's putting strains on the planet. Some of the findings that, you know, roughly 75% of the land area has been impacted by human activity. It's taking a toll. And the more people we have, the more careful we need to be about our impacts. And that's not the model that we've been operating under.
What are some of the things that human beings are doing to accelerate this?
Habitat destruction remains the biggest cause of species endangerment, but it's closely followed by invasive species. Careless global trade basically is just bringing species and diseases into new places, and it's just wreaking havoc. And exploitation remains a serious threat to many species, particularly in our oceans. The report highlighted that roughly a third of all fisheries are unsustainable. And then finally, climate change is just a growing threat for species, and particularly in combination with habitat destruction, because species' ability to move in response to climate change is limited by habitat loss and fragmentation. Here in the U.S., the leading edge of the extinction crisis is really in our rivers and streams and our freshwater habitats. And the report highlights around the world, you know, roughly 80 to 90% of all wetlands have been lost. In the U.S., the most species that have gone extinct are freshwater species. I think that really highlights the point of the report about how the degradation that's leading to loss of species is also leading to declines in our quality of life. I mean, obviously, we all need water to survive, and then rivers and streams, particularly clean ones, are a source of enjoyment and solace for people. And the fact that we've degraded our rivers, you know, on such a massive scale, you know, really highlights the problem.
What are the top things that humans are doing to cause these problems?
Our agriculture, our food systems in particular, lead to massive amount of habitat destruction. Urbanization likewise leads to a lot of habitat destruction. And both agricultural and urban sprawl lead to a lot of pollution in our waterways. Even, you know, the problem with coral reefs in a lot of cases, it's development that leads to their loss. So obviously we need agriculture, we need food, but there's ways we can do that that are smarter and that don't pollute our rivers and don't involve massive use of pesticides that are leading to insect decline and threaten to unravel these ecosystems that we all depend on.
Is this reversible, or is it just something that we can at least try to slow down or stop? And if so, how likely is it that we can find the will around the world to do that?
There's certainly hope, and yes, this is reversible, and we can certainly slow the loss. Protecting habitats. We have a lot of natural areas that still remain. E.O. Wilson and many other scientists have been trumpeting this idea of half the earth for nature. And when you look at the materials that they've prepared, we're not really as far away from that as it sounds. You know, there are a lot of areas that remain relatively untouched, such as the boreal forest in Canada and Russia, much of the Amazon basin in South America. You know, if we can manage to protect these areas, we can reverse a lot of the damage. And then, of course, we have to get a handle on our emission of greenhouse gases in order to have really any hope.
All right, that's Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. The House Judiciary Committee set a vote for Wednesday on whether to cite Attorney General William Barr with contempt over his refusal to provide the panel with a full, unredacted version of the special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report and underlying evidence from the probe. Separately, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said he would not provide the House Ways and Means Committee with 6 years of Trump's individual and business tax returns, despite a formal request by the chairman under a law authorizing such actions. Both developments put the lawmakers on a course leading to federal court action as the Trump administration escalates its push to block multiple probes by the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. Georgetown University law professor Victoria Norris, who studies the separation of powers, says the Trump legal team seems to be pushing a theory that's been shot down before by the Supreme Court in the past.
The president's legal advisors are pursuing a theory that's actually novel. It's new. It's called the unitary executive, where he has all power over the executive branch, including Mueller.
Moore says her biggest fear, though, is that the courts might eventually rule President Trump must comply with the subpoenas, but still refuses to do so.
That would be a true constitutional crisis, because, in fact, you had would have one branch saying to the other branch, the courts, I'm not going to pay attention to you, in which case there is no way to resolve that. The only way to resolve it would be, in fact, impeachment under the Constitution.
Almost 500 former U.S. Justice Department officials on Monday in a joint statement said that the Mueller report's findings would justify obstruction charges against President Trump if he were not currently occupying the White House. Attorney General Barr has said he found insufficient evidence to conclude that Trump obstructed justice. Well, President Trump's escalation of a trade war with China left plans in limbo Monday for high-level negotiations later this week to end the dispute. Stocks around the world tumbled and oil prices hit a one-month low after Trump tweeted Sunday that he would raise tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods by the end of the week and soon target the remaining Chinese imports with tariffs. The announcement ended a four-month truce in a trade war that has cost the world's two largest economies billions of dollars, slowed global growth, and disrupted manufacturing and farming. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Phil Levy, senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, if the president is ready to follow through with the tariff threat.
That's the $200 billion question. It's a threat that he's made before, and he was bluffing. So we've had a deadline that looked very much like this deadline that was for January 1st, one for March 1st, and both of those went by the wayside. This one has a much shorter lead time, and we'll see if he means it.
Why would he mean it? Why, if he has said over the past month or so that the talks were going along very well and everything we had heard coming from the talks seem to amplify that. Why would he bluff?
President Trump has declared that his negotiations go well almost no matter what's happening. He'll declare that a very minor agreement is a fabulous agreement. The statement that things were going great plays well at elections. It plays well with markets when you want to give the impression that you're making great progress and you are a master negotiator. He's been setting himself up for trouble on this China deal because they were never headed towards the kind of big, broad, comprehensive deal that he promised. It wasn't going to happen. And that was setting him up for a choice between either having a much more minor deal where each side declared success or having a breakdown. It seems like the prompt for Sunday's tweets from the president was a statement by the Chinese that they were not going to actually write new laws on some of the issues that the U.S. had been concerned about.
The China markets have been having their problems, as has the Chinese economy. Where does a bluff like this leave the financial world?
It leaves it in a bit of a quandary, and it leaves it in a state where it has to do some very quick reassessments. The financial world had been notably optimistic about these talks. They believed the president's happy talk. The president had been promising that this problem was about to be fixed. I think what you're seeing is just the start of a reassessment, that there's still a question in people's mind whether this is a bluff and whether anything will be really different come Friday. But if they decide that it is, there's going to be some very rapid reassessments, both in financial markets and when you get to companies who are deciding where they're going to make purchases and where they're going to ship.
And what about the Chinese economy? Where does it leave that?
The Chinese economy has had more than its share of troubles, although it's worth noting that a troubled Chinese economy is one that grows at a little faster than 6%, whereas the U.S. economy grows at 3%. It's also worth noting that a lot of the troubles they've had stem from things beyond U.S. trade problems. So they've got issues with debt, for example. They would clearly like to reach a solution. And it is also clear that if we have a breakdown, this will be damaging to the Chinese economy. That said, it's not clear that President Trump has offered them a viable alternative to having a breakdown like that.
What do you think needs to be done? What kind of movement does either or both sides have to do to reach some kind of agreement?
It's going to be very hard to get something that's satisfactory by the end of this week. The Trump administration was way too scattered in its approach, way too far-reaching in its requests. There are important solutions that we could reach with the Chinese, but it's not something you do between Monday and Friday. The ideal that would happen is they would make what progress they can, accept that result, and then figure that there's more work to be done.
What does this whole threat for increased tariffs by the end of the week do to U.S. relationships with Euro markets, with other markets around the world?
I think it makes us look even more predictable than we've appeared to be under this president. It also has the potential to further undermine U.S. credibility. One of the real tools that a White House has to shape events and policy and other actors' roles in the world scene is you can make pronouncements and people believe you. This is literally the third time President Trump has announced a deadline for raising these tariffs from 10 to 25%. He didn't mean it on the first two. If he pulls back again, it's hard to see why anybody would believe him.
That's Phil Levy, senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, former senior economist for trade for President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Prince Harry is expressing his joy over his wife, Meghan, giving birth to a healthy baby boy. AP correspondent Zuria Shakely reports.
Meghan and myself had a baby boy.
The baby, who's not yet been named, is seventh in line for the British throne and is Queen Elizabeth II's eighth great-grandchild.
This little thing is absolutely to die for, so I'm just over the moon.
It's the first child for Harry and Meghan, who married a year ago. Harry told reporters the pair were both absolutely thrilled and so grateful.
The most amazing experience I could ever possibly imagine.
Harry has long spoken of his desire to start a family. Zaria Shakili, London.
Well, the virtual reality documentary Traveling While Black by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Roger Ross Williams immerses the viewer in what travel was like for Black Americans during the Jim Crow era of the 1950s and 60s, when racial segregation was widespread across much of the U.S. Black motorists and travelers could consult the Green Book, a guide to lodging, restaurants, and bathrooms around the country that catered to African Americans. The film focuses on one of them, Ben's Chili Bowl, a landmark D.C. diner that provided sanctuary for the African American traveler. The film was part of D.C.'s film festival. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with patrons at Ben's Chili Bowl and the producers of the VR documentary.
The Green Book was a guide for African Americans to travel safely, to find shelter, food, and gas in a time when these basic rights were not guaranteed.
In the documentary Traveling While Black, African American patrons at Ben's Chili Bowl reflect on their experiences traveling during the Jim Crow era. One of them is Sandra Butler Truesdale, a native Washingtonian. She relates how blacks had to sit in the back of public buses or the last car of the train and use separate bathrooms, which were rarely available.
The most, I think, difficult thing was the fact that you could not relieve yourself on the train or the bus.
Butler Truesdale remembers coming to Ben's Chili Bowl since she was a girl.
It was a sanctuary. You could meet and talk about politics and talk about legislation and talk about the things that would help as a race.
Traveling While Black executive producer Bonnie Nelson Schwartz says she produced the documentary after staging a theater play on the same topic in Washington 10 years ago. It was called The Green Book. She says audiences reacted viscerally.
And after the play, they began standing up one by one, telling stories about when they traveled in the South during segregation and their families used the Green Book, about not being able to stop anywhere, about being threatened, never having a meal on the trip, always having to pack a picnic lunch and eat by the roadside.
10 years later, her documentary Traveling While Black is receiving international acclaim, which doesn't surprise her.
I think probably immigration is part of that. It's always people who are not of the community moving in. There is a backlash, obviously, in many cities in Europe to immigration. And so there is friction and there is conflict. And what this film hopes to do is begin a conversation.
Sandra Butler Truesdale says the documentary also sparks conversation on race relations in America's streets today.
It's the same thing now with our young black males. We teach them early on how to behave in case they are arrested or in case they are stopped. For the most part, they're trained early on how they should behave.
The virtual reality film immerses the viewer into the intimate discussions black families are having about race while dining at Ben's Chili Bowl, says producer Stéphane Etoui.
You forget about the technology. You forget about having a headset on. And you really feel connecting to the place where you are, this new reality.
Traveling While Black deals with the same era as the Academy Award-winning picture Green Book, which was criticized as whitewashing the black traveling experience during the Jim Crow era. Bonnie Nelson Schwartz has a different take.
The Hollywood film is a personal story. I understand there's a lot of anger, that it is not a fair portrait, but it's one man's portrait based on his book. This experience with this film will begin conversations in museums and in communities all over the country.
Penelope Fulu, VOA News, Washington 1.
Lady Gaga makes an entrance once again. This time it was a 16-minute entrance at the Met Gala. Also known as the Met Ball, it's an annual fundraising gala for the benefit of the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Costume Institute in New York City. It marks the opening of the Costume Institute's annual fashion exhibit. Each year's event celebrates the theme of that year's Costume Institute exhibition. The 71st annual gala hit a high point early with Gaga working the pink carpet to its fullest in a long golden with long golden eyelashes and a huge pink dress, peeling off layer after layer until she was down to a bra, panties, and fishnet stockings. Brandon Maxwell, who created Gaga's reveal, helped her navigate the stairs at the Met as she posed with several helpers. He undressed her further, revealing a black strapless asymmetrical ball gown underneath with a huge side bustle, and then she undressed again to show off a pink dress reminiscent of Marilyn Monroe. Moments later, she did it again, undressing to pose in a glittering bra and panty set with huge platform shoes. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm